Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, a weekly roundup of interesting news and discussions from the past week, plus quite often an interview topic or maybe more in-depth discussions on a particular topic. I am your host, Christian Schiller. This podcast episode also accompanies a newsletter where you can find the topics that are discussed and make up your own minds. You can find more about me on christianschiller.com or at christianch on Twitter, especially some of the other shows and newsletters that I now run. For those of you joining me from my old Gregarious Mammal show, some of the tone here will be similar, but I have gone back to doing the show alone, and maybe the topics will be slightly broader than pure tech. Okay, let's get started. A few EU-related news. I am based here in Berlin. The EU is one of the many government institutions surrounding me. And there was a couple of interesting topics, technology-related, that came up regarding the EU in the past couple of weeks. And as this is a first show of the new year, we are not going to be just covering things for the past week. So the first one that attracted my attention was from John Fingers over on Engadget. And this is the EU offering bounties to help find security flaws in open source tools. These bounties will start in January and focus on a specific 14 tools that the EU and some of its institutions use most widely. These include a lot of tools you've probably heard of, things like VLC, Drupal, which I used to actually contribute to way back, and even the GNU C library. Bounties are actually pretty reasonable, from about 25,000 to 90,000, and are running throughout most of this year. So while, of course, the EU is not 100% guaranteeing that fulfilling these bounties will prevent problems in the future, it's interesting to see that institutions who use open source software are starting to step up and fund some of the development that needs to happen to keep them running in the most efficient and secure ways. And there'll be a bit more on open source I'll be circling back to a little bit after this specific EU section. And then somewhat related to security and the EU again, it was an article on Wired from Chris Stokel-Walker. And this was a fascinating title. The EU doesn't really have a plan to stop its elections being hacked. For those of you who are not aware, of course, the EU is comprised of 27. Well, that number may change in the near future, and that's something I'll come to in a minute. Member nations, and it doesn't necessarily dictate how they should run their elections, but does offer some kind of institutional support around security and checking that those elections have happened fairly. But this is more specifically focusing on the European level elections that do happen. And as this sort of strange Uber body over member states' governments, the fact that their elections could be rigged with a fairly powerful institutional body is also quite important. It's actually interesting that quite a few people quoted in this article from the EU and from other places mentioned that the DNC hack in 2016, which wasn't that long ago really, was what has really started a lot of these governments looking seriously into election rigging, election hacking. And in some respects, it's kind of crazy that, especially bearing in mind usually the length of election cycles, it's happening so recently. Another interesting aspect in here was that Estonia is held up as an interesting example of a country that is doing very well. But it's also interesting because there have been reports in the past that their online election system is not as secure as it could be. I also once witnessed the project lead of the e-residency program at an event here voting at a conference to show how simple the system was. So I'm not saying that that means it's insecure, but maybe drawing so much attention to its simplicity opens it up to even more potential for hijacking. And of course, there are the usual players that the security is being put in place against: Russia, North Korea, China, Iran as well. So we shall see what happens in elections later this year and in 2020, I guess, and see if these measures have been successful. Because in some of the other elections of recent times, I think the French election was held up as a good example, that security went surprisingly well and things weren't influenced. So we shall see if lessons have been learned enough to keep up with the hackers. And finally, in EU news or non-EU news, depending how you look at it, this was an article from Steve Ranger over on, I'm going to go for the British pronunciation, ZDNet, about tech investment falling as Brexit gathers strength, maybe. I found this interesting because, having a look at the total funding in 2018, London got 1.8 billion, which was down from about 2.5 billion the year before. But its nearest rival is Berlin with 936 million. So even in a time when investments are down in London, its nearest rival is at half investment, which I found quite staggering, actually. And whilst I am very much pro-European and pro-Remain, and I have no qualms with saying that, I think there are bits of me at the back of my mind that kind of think that, despite the fact I'd rather it didn't happen, that business will be as usual quite potentially in Britain post-Brexit, because really it hasn't made a huge impact so far, bearing in mind that I think from reports I feel like I've seen that global investments are down anyway. So this isn't necessarily unique to the UK and the EU. But still, it was interesting just to see how much investment goes into the UK still. Whether that remains, I guess, is something that's interesting to be seen. And another interesting fact here is that Cambridge, another city in the UK, is actually at the bottom of the top 10. So the UK actually has two cities in the top 10. So it's not... that's not too bad, I guess, in some respects. And now, sweeping back to what I alluded to earlier and talking about open source and sustainability of open source, this has been a hotly discussed topic recently, actually, and I won't go into too much detail right now. It might be something I'll come back for a more in-detailed discussion in the coming months. But around, I guess, the maturity of open source, but the negative sides of what's happening here, there's been a lot of, I suppose it's more circumstantial evidence to show, without digging massively into financial reporting of various open source companies, that a lot of open source companies that traditionally made their money out of commercial options, commercial support, hosted versions of their software, are beginning to feel the pinch because of cloud providers providing their software, plus obviously a fully supported and maintained set of servers and instances to run that on, plus all the other software they're likely to need, and providing it generally in a far better and more feature-packed way than some of the specific software vendors. And this is problematic, of course, because it means these vendors are not making any money anymore, or not making as much money anymore, to continue supporting the open source versions. And I have heard from a few people who work at companies who I won't mention, but some major open source vendors that are experiencing this problem. And firstly, there was an interesting article on a blog called The Observation Deck from Brian Cantrill, talking about some of the background behind this and some of the strange licensing that has come out of a few companies recently to attempt to combat this, but maybe not handling it the best way they could. And the fallout from some of that, I guess, with the best of intentions, they were trying to protect open source projects, but maybe it could have been handled better. And then, interestingly, I think just a couple of days ago, AWS, of course, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, cloud vendor at the moment, has repeatedly in the past created pretty much its own versions of popular software. Did a similar thing with Mongo, one of the many companies that is feeling the pinch from the pressure of cloud vendors. And AWS launched a new service called DocumentDB. And actually, sometimes when you browse the AWS product pages to see the amount of products they have, it's quite staggering. They really seem to do have a product for everything. I did have some discussions with some people at Mongo who claim that DocumentDB doesn't really touch most of what Mongo does. But of course, we all know that being the best and having the best features is not always the most important thing, and that people generally use fairly limited feature selection, so maybe it won't matter. I guess the interesting aspect, of course, is that, as far as I know, pretty much most of the software equivalents that AWS creates are not open sourced, so they're not really given back to the community in any way, shape, or form. And while Mongo has some fairly strong commercial components, it still does have a core open source project that people can use. And I guess the thing that stuck in my mind the most about this was this whole aspect of AWS kind of saying, well, if we don't get what we want, we'll just make it ourselves. And then you get this sort of somewhat black box software that no one really has any insight into. And I guess the other interesting aspect before I wrap up on this is that AWS and Amazon haven't contributed much of what they have learned or created through AWS back to open source, whereas Google Cloud from Google and Microsoft Azure from Microsoft have. And a lot of the products that they have created are contributed back. Not all, of course, but more, I think, than AWS, which is interesting. So not all cloud vendors are created equally. And if you need another reason to dislike Amazon, there's another one there. Again, we will see if that matters to people and if supporting open source properly actually really matters, or if they just want the convenience and everything in one place. And finally, rounding up the topics that caught my interest this year, or this week, if you like, was firstly, actually both of these are from The Guardian. One from Jordan Kistner on an interesting piece of technology that is helping people who can't speak. And of course, one of the classic examples of some software like this is the one that Stephen Hawking used to use. But there are, of course, many others and used by less famous people. And I suppose this is always one of these nice aspects. It's always interesting and pleasant to come back to the fact that there are technologies that are definitely used for good, some not, some can be suspect, and there are definitely some that are used for good. And helping people communicate in ways they couldn't before is definitely one of those. And this is quite an interesting article about a couple of different pieces of software, one in a particular called Vocal ID, about how they actually build up a profile of someone's voice, preferably before they lose it. But of course, this isn't always possible. But and then they will create a relatively authentic generated voice from those samples, which I find quite fascinating. And obviously, it prevents you getting the overtly robotic voice that I guess earlier versions like Stephen Hawking used are famous for. Related to accessibility, and this sort of came up in my research because I was helping create an article on ways to make the web more accessible recently. And this was something from Chris Ashton, who works for the BBC, actually, but on Smashing Magazine, which is a German publication, about using the web for a day using a screen reader. And I think this is very interesting. This is another one of those, God, I say interesting a lot, don't I? One of those, I can't think of anything else to say, but interesting now, where often developers especially are accused of creating software in perfect conditions, creating software that works great on a high-speed internet connection, but not thinking about users in places where that doesn't exist. And this applies to people who use accessibility tools to browse the web, including screen readers, that a lot of modern, highly complex layouts are terrible for screen readers. And if you use the web with a screen reader, you appreciate that, and then you are more passionate or motivated to change it, of course. So I would urge any kind of budding web designer / developer to have a read of this just to get an idea of what it's like and try it yourself. I shudder to think what some of my web presences are like with a screen reader. I think it's a good exercise to try and just to appreciate how other people browse the web. And finally, going completely randomly, another article from The Guardian from Mark O'Connell, a title that really grabbed my eye because I love kind of these crazy conspiracy theories and dystopian visions and things like that. Why Silicon Valley billionaires are prepping for the apocalypse in New Zealand. And I actually spoke to a few New Zealand friends after sharing this, who did confirm this has been happening for a little while. But this is the tale of a handful of fairly wealthy, mostly Silicon Valley and other American entrepreneurs buying property in New Zealand because they feel that when the shit hits the proverbial fan, it'd be a good place to ride out the apocalypse. Whether that's true, when it's surrounded by so much water and is also famous for earthquakes, I'm not 100% sure. But the article is quite fascinating, and the way that the article is written is reminiscent of like an old sort of Lovecraftian or 1920s detective novel of the writer following these obscure paths and getting snatches of conversations from people who might have an idea about shady things that happen, and then they get a moment to sneak into a ranch of a particular Silicon Valley entrepreneur. And yeah, it's just quite a fascinating read, and I guess not surprising, but surprising. So that was my roundup of interesting tidbits from the news that caught my eyes over the past week or so. Still sharpening up the format. I hope you enjoyed some of those and go and have a read of some of the articles yourself. And please, if you have anything you'd like me to consider and take a look at, then you can find my contact details on christianchiller.com/contact. I'd love to hear from you and some feedback, of course. But to round off this show, here is an interview I did about a month ago now, but then the holidays got in the way of releasing it under the old podcast. This is an interview I did with Rachel Black, a developer advocate at a company here in Berlin called Lisk. I have interviewed Lisk before, their CMO, Thomas. You can find that interview on an episode of the Curious Mammal podcast. It was quite a popular episode. And Lisk is a blockchain-based company that is, I guess, trying to do things a little differently and has always, in my mind, worked a lot harder to make a usable and useful experience for developers. And in this interview, we talk about Lisk a bit, we talk about the roadmap, but we also have a more general conversation about working in developer relations in the blockchain space and the kind of unique aspects that technical culture has, plus also developer relations more broadly and funding companies. And it's a fairly wide-ranging discussion, so I hope you enjoy.
My name is Rachel. I'm a tech evangelist here at Lisk. I have a development background, so I was working for a number of years in London at a number of startups, a JavaScript background, so mainly working with React and also some Node. And it's over there whilst I kind of got the blockchain bug, started going to loads of meetups and eventually helping to kind of organize meetups and then also speaking at meetups. So it's kind of from then that I kind of got a taste for the kind of evangelism side of thing and the developer relations thing. So this is how I've kind of ended up now working at Lisk in the tech evangelist role, which is super exciting. So Lisk, it's we're a blockchain application platform. We are building the tools to allow people to build decentralized applications. There's a number of other players kind of doing similar things. What differentiates us is that we have like a very very strong focus on accessibility. Mm-hmm. And this is something we've kind of had from day one, which is why we chose our language as JavaScript. We're now migrating some of that over to TypeScript because we find it's actually really beneficial for our developers.
It didn't have quite enough levels of abstraction, so you should probably add another one.
Yeah, well, TypeScript's working for us, so it's exciting to bring that in. We build the infrastructure for you to create this decentralized app, and we're doing that in a slightly different way to kind of the smart contracts that you'd get on, say, Ethereum. One of our kind of key offerings is sidechains. Mm-hmm. So the kind of future that we envision is that you would be able to go to Lisk, use our developer tooling, so Elements and Commander, which are kind of a very core part of what we do. Use that to kind of build your own sidechain, and then in that sidechain, your distributed app would live. And then that can communicate to the Lyft main chain, and then, you know, in the future potentially to other side chains. So it's a blockchain application platform which is using side chains to kind of bring scalability and customization to the ecosystem.
Is the Lyft main chain public within Lyft, or
Lyft main chain is public? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, but just within Lyft, or in theory to, I don't know, any kind of random HTTP call or something.
You can run if you run a node, you can run a private node to kind of, we have an API layer. Yeah. So we have both HTTP and we have...
But it's not behind authentication or no. It's completely public domain chain.
Yeah, yeah. So anyone can pull down and run a node. We have delegates who may run a node. The ledger is public, so mm-hmm. you can go and track how many Lysks have been spent. It's a public ledger in that sense. We have delegates who also run nodes, and some of them run it with slightly more privacy because they're obviously they're forging, you know. But yeah, we have public APIs.
Mm-hmm. I spoke with Thomas 6 months. No, actually, it was about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Let's go with 6 months.
Yeah,
maybe slightly less, but let's go for 6 months. Sounds better. And have there been any? Let's start with if there's been any major developments since then
or
major changes. So this all got kicked off by, I went to your first birthday party, which was the big relaunch. Things went a little quiet.
Yeah.
I know you've been hiring a lot,
mm-hmm.
which implies something is happening, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
But so what has happened in the past 6 months?
Yeah, so actually we've done quite a lot. And I think when you spoke to Thomas, they were in the process of launching 1.0 mm-hmm. to testnet. That's gone to mainnet. And since then we've been releasing quite a number of, I think we've had 3 minor releases, and we're keeping up much more kind of incremental releases, and that's going to be part of our development process going forward. So that happened back at the end of summer. The last couple of weeks, we've had 2 big announcements, and mm-hmm. that is our revised roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very detailed document, which kind of, it breaks down from where we are now to our full sidechain development kit.
Let's just go into that in a bit more detail, then we get to number 2. Is it revised in terms of detail or timelines or both?
We've released it without timelines because we're seeing sort of that this is, kind of becoming an industry standard to do that. And we want to make sure that we maintain the trust, and it is a hard thing to do. So we don't want to set up, false expectations, but the roadmap can definitely be used as a guide for prioritization and the order that we're going to do things in. Of course, everything that we do is on GitHub and is public, so it's completely out there for the community to kind of track our progress and how we're achieving those milestones on the roadmap. But yeah.
And apart from increased detail, is there anything new in terms of items or order or?
Yeah. So, one of the big things is, and this kind of ties into the other part of our announcement, is this LIPS, which is mm-hmm. Lisk Improvement Proposal.
Oh, this is number 2 or?
Yeah. Okay. So
we have the IPS or however they pronounce it.
Exactly. So just as we had BIPs, the Bitcoin Improvement Proposals.
BIPs, IPS, LIPS.
Exactly. Following the kind of industry naming convention there. But these are technical and academic documents that detail what we do both on a protocol layer, and we also have application layer ones as well. So it's really bringing a lot more kind of transparency and detail to the milestones in the roadmap. So it's not just a kind of superficial roadmap in the sense that we think we're going to do this and, we might do that. It's really bringing the kind of solid technical backbone to the roadmap. Mm-hmm. And we launched with 9 LIPS, but we've got a team of cryptographers, serious academic backgrounds. They're working on them full time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be more coming out as they are finished. And also our development team is also producing a LIPS for kind of application architecture. So there's sort of 2 levels there.
Was this a reaction to things that people were asking for in terms of specific LIPS or?
It's about us having a transparent process. Mm-hmm. It's obviously we've got our team here at Lightcurve who are working on these LIPS. And we want to be very clear with the community in terms of this is why we're doing what we're doing, and this is the reason for it. So it's for transparency for us.
Mm.
But it's also nice in the sense that it gives the community an opportunity to also be part of that process. either through feedback or if they actually want to submit their mm-hmm. own lip, it is completely open. So it's very much about having a kind of collaborative and transparent process. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, we see that very much as kind of part of, you know, kind of part of the ethos of being open source and including people in the decision-making process.
This gets into an interesting territory. I don't think it's something you ever covered before.
Mm.
And you may or may not have an answer right now, because as far as I'm aware, you're mostly VC and like crowdfunding funded.
Oh, so we did an ICO back in 2016.
So purely ICO. Yeah. So in terms of, and I know this is always the horrible question to every tech startup. Mm. I don't necessarily want to get into terms of monetization in that, will it work? But is there an end goal intention of it being a SaaS-style platform in terms of people will pay for levels of access or something like that? Or is that not being considered yet? Or
mm-hmm.
And there is a reason I'm asking this question, but...
So
which I'll get to in a minute, but...
So we have a separation between the LISC Foundation,
mm-hmm.
Which is responsible for sort of managing the funds and kind of all the legalities around the ICO and the structure. And here at... But our core team is actually, we're employed via Lightcurve. Mm-hmm. So there's a separation there. So Lightcurve is kind of a sort of for-profit software consultancy, basically, which is building on the LISC platform.
Okay.
And this is something that you see in a lot of other blockchain projects. So the actual foundation itself, obviously, you know, it holds a lot of LISC. So if, you know, LISC grows and it becomes successful, then it gets monetary gain from that.
So LISC at the moment is intended to remain... free to use as a platform.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the reason I asked this question was around potential, you know, there's always been this weird balancing act sometimes with some open source projects of when sometimes some contributors become a bit too bigger than others.
Mm-hmm.
And through the lips, I was wondering if there may be the potential of like client sway, but if there is no kind of client priority, then I suppose it probably is something that won't happen
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
quite yet. I mean, mm-hmm. If things change, who knows? But and has anyone submitted any yet apart from the team?
So we only released it like 2 weeks ago. So so the requirements to submit a LIP, it is quite detailed. Mm. And we've kind of set the bar quite high in terms of the content there. So we haven't had one in yet, but we definitely welcome that.
Well, have people been interacting with
people have been interacting with them, and it's all up there on GitHub for people to read. And we've, you know, had people signing up to our mailing list, and the submissions will come. And I think certainly there are kind of milestones on our development roadmap that are, you know, potentially more contentious, so we can definitely envision a lot more kind of community contributions and debate around that. But the interesting thing about LIPS also is that we're also building out our partnerships. So we are building out partnerships with King's College London, and also
I'd actually like to come to partnerships in these cases in a minute.
Yeah,
I just wanted you just kind of tossed me a bit of bait there that I couldn't resist. Controversial roadmap items.
Yeah. So yeah, of course. I think one of the potential controversial ones is we're a DPoS, a delegated proof of stake consensus mechanism. So we are looking at ways to kind of make that fairer and more equitable and kind of improve engagement from the community so that delegates are... there is like competition between delegates, and that we're very lucky in the sense that we have seen some really fantastic contributions from the delegate community. So we've had... elite center opened up in Shanghai,
mm-hmm.
And we have more projects like that coming on board, and we have very active members who are kind of running meetup groups, contributing to our code and identifying bugs. So we really want to kind of facilitate it, so we're kind of fostering that active contribution to the LISC network, and that's something that, of course, in any DPoS system, there is a lot of contention around any changes to these mechanisms. Yeah. So I think that's potentially would be one of the most contentious ones. And also, I think one of the trickier ones, and I think this is a tricky thing for kind of the industry, industry wide, is this kind of sidechain communication interoperability piece. There are various ways about doing this. We are believers in kind of doing a decentralized approach. So we could do a very superficial sidechain communication. This is something we could kind of implement now, but we want to do it in a decentralized way. And there are a number of approaches to doing that. And I think with having lips and kind of giving enough room for debate around that, will get us in a position where we are getting the solution that's, you know, best for not just that we think is best at Lightcurve, but it's also best for the community as well. So wanting to be very collaborative there.
And then is this, I'd actually be interested to know what's the separation between kind of issues in a repository and lips? And I know this sounds strange because the word issue is obviously fairly weighted, but often people use it for all sorts of, things. But is it an opportunity to break out the more theoretical issues into discussion as opposed to just pure code contributions and things like that?
So with lips, we are pushing, I mean, most of the conversation on lips happens on a mailing list, which is similar to the BIPs process, because it's not really suited for like people creating issues on GitHub and that kind of, that's more suited for kind of, you know, pull requests and that kind of level of conversation. And it is quite detailed, and it's, you know, these are hard topics that require like thoughtful discussion and thoughtful debate. So mailing list is the medium that we've chosen for that. And that's, you know, something that we're all partaking in as well.
Okay. So let's go back to what you started to talk about, partnerships, use cases. I would think that partnerships and use cases were somewhat overlapped, but maybe not. But let's start with the partnerships, and if use cases are relevant, mention those. If not, we'll go to use cases afterwards.
So in terms of, I mean, I guess there's a separation in the sense of people that we're partnering with in terms of our academic research for lips. So we can partner with universities on that, and it's certainly a very nice mechanism for you know, students and university members to get exposure to this really exciting area of technology. When it comes to kind of use cases, this quarter we've hired on the business development side, so we are, you know, we're very much going through the process. I think we're going to be launching a business paper soon, so I don't want to say too much about that. But we are, you know, obviously we're actively kind of researching and, you know, looking for a kind of first sort of projects on board, and what industry is that going to be in. These are very active conversations that are ongoing in Lightcurve at the moment.
All right, well, let's dig a little deeper into that. I mean, in terms of, I mean, you know, we all know that the blockchain space is sometimes a little guilty of lots of people making things and not so many people making things with those things. So we can give a little bit of an excuse there, because everybody's having the same problem. But are people building? And if so, what are they building?
So with Lisk currently, we've had our main chain operational. The next phase of development that we're about to go into is our architecture and design phase. And that's to kind of give us a very modular and flexible design for our core. After that, we will be able to release our Alpha SDK, which is our first offering of the SDK. So it's...
Because I think the SDKs were announced at the first birthday, and they're still coming.
So it's, and I think this is kind of a thing that we've seen industry wide is that the development actually does take a lot longer.
Well, okay, let's go back a step then. So, can people build at the moment? You can build at the moment. You can write contracts, can't you? I think
no. So currently you can run nodes, and nodes have like, so there's APIs associated with nodes, so you can build. You can build like apps that would kind of work with Lisk as a currency level, as a kind of what the main chain does. And the main chain is, it's we've deliberately made it quite limited in the functionality that it has. So it's mainly around sending transactions and obviously also voting for delegates. We wanted to like not add too much complexity there. So you can kind of interact with it on that level. But when we come to creating, you know, our SDK offerings, it will be more around you're able to create your own sidechain and you can set up your own custom transactions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you probably want different transactions than we've got on main chain, and that will be specific to your use case and what your application does. So the first SDK offering will be after the architecture and design phase is completed. But that's going to be Alpha SDK. So it is going to be pretty slimmed down. We won't have all of the support of our developer tooling, which is kind of really what we want to give people. So it will be more for more adventurous developers and, you know, potentially ones that we have relationships with. After that, we've also got a beta SDK and release candidate SDK, and they'll be increasingly supported by Elements and Commander. So you'll be able to kind of use Commander to, you know, set up a lot of the tasks for you to kind of create your sidechain, and that will take a lot of the pain out for developers. And then using Elements, which is our library, and we're increasingly pulling out, we're going through a process of pulling out bits of core, rewriting it in Elements, and then it'll be consumed in core again via Elements. So Elements will kind of become like the building blocks, but also Commander is like a super useful tool. Once we get onto beta and release candidate SDK, there'll be much more support for more tooling.
So basically at the moment, you have the, it is possible to have sidechains, which I think you create from the, I can't remember the exact tool, but I remember doing it.
So currently we don't have sidechain communication.
Okay. I feel like I did something.
No, we don't. It's interesting, because sidechain communication is actually coming at the end of our roadmap. And the reason for that is that we've really wanted to prioritize getting the SDKs out, because as a developer, if you want to work with Lisk and you want to build your decentralized app or your proof of concept, the sidechain communication part, that's actually the last part you need. You need to be able to create the app. You need to be able to, you know, create the sidechain that it's going to live on, and you need the support of the tooling there. Yeah, so that will come last. So currently you can run a node. We've got quite a number of node operators, and you can interact with the node. So we have people in the community who are they're building kind of fun tools on top of Lisk main chain, which is kind of not really the intention, but it's great that people are kind of already playing around and getting a feel for that.
If something's public, people will do something with
it. Exactly. That's the joy of open source development.
So how are they building that at the moment then?
So a number of projects. We have things like we have one which is a website that you can, it's more of a kind of like, these are more kind of passion projects or hobby things.
Sure.
Stuff like, we've had an integration with If This Then That. So you can hook it up. So if somebody sends lists, then you can add your triggers. It could be a text message.
It's leveraging some kind of standard.
Exactly. So it's kind of building on top of the main chain. Ultimately, you know, it will go much beyond that when we have SDKs.
But the smart contract language, for want of a better word, that exists, or that's still also in development?
So we are not using a smart contract approach. Sure. We have a transaction-based approach.
Okay.
And the reason is that we found that actually for most use cases, you don't need the full scope of writing a smart contract. Now, it may be in the future that we build that into one of our sidechains, and because we also have a modular approach, we can build that in. But for now, we have set transactions in Lisk main chain, and then we will allow users, when they create their dApps, they'll also be able to set up their transactions, because the reality is you don't need that kind of full kind of Turing.
But when you mentioned JavaScript earlier, what is that doing at the moment? And when do people need the JavaScript?
Okay, so essentially we say JavaScript, although TypeScript is coming
TypeScript,
more part of it. That's okay. So it's in some ways, we're more of a kind of Node.js project. So
okay.
we have each of our nodes is a node server.
Is a node node.
Yeah, exactly. It's a node node. It's a node node.
Okay, yeah.
So to work with it, obviously, JavaScript background, node background is going to really set you up there. So yeah, it's a node server, and we're using Postgres and quite a number of different things. And then it's obviously got the technology to speak to other nodes. So that's kind of broadly how it works.
Okay, this is interesting. Now you've mentioned that to me, having worked in this, also in this space in the past, this is sounding increasingly like a somewhat traditional distributed database, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, I mean,
with a slightly more advanced consensus model, maybe.
I think so. I mean, I think if we can kind of come more towards a developer of experience of that, I think that can actually be a real asset, because writing smart contracts and getting your head around, you know, Solidity and that whole process, something like that, that can be a hurdle in itself. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we still have, you know, the whole kind of all the cryptography to back up the distributed ledger in Lisk. So it's kind of, in some ways, yes, it is bringing in some of that familiar environment to development, but still holding on to the kind of...
It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's, it's probably going to be a criticism that some people might have. I don't know. I'm not sure. Again, as we were talking earlier before we started recording, was, you know, blockchain use cases are small. It's a still a significant amount of projects in terms of sheer numbers, but actually the amount that probably need that is still, it's not every application. So there are plenty of applications where a distributed database is fine and that's all they need. But when you come to the ability for people to transfer ownership and things like that without a central kind of authority, then
yeah,
becomes more interesting. So yeah, there are still use cases for just a purely decentralized distributed database.
Definitely. But I mean, we are 100% a kind of blockchain project, so we are kind of marrying, there's elements of the developer experience that mirror something that people are familiar with, but also bringing in the decentralized element as well. And you're completely right. I think certainly what we'll see when blockchain becomes more widely adopted is that maybe it's only a small part of an application that it is utilizing blockchain, and maybe there will still be a lot of the kind of traditional tech that supplements that as well.
This is actually digging slightly further here, because there was, is still, I think, another project in Berlin that was attempting to do something similar in a slightly different way, which is BigchainDB, who, in terms of blockchain startups, are relatively old, and especially the company that came before them, which was a bit of an odd idea in that it was a database under the hood with a blockchain on top to kind of give transactional support, which is actually often what is missing in distributed databases anyway. And I am never entirely clear how successful they've been with this. So in terms of moving forward, is that a project you look at to see, here's some things we'll do differently, or we are doing this differently, or we are different completely? Because their model was pretty different. I know they kind of had the whole side project to make like a large public database of databases, which I don't know if that ever really happened, but if you were, as a normal person, to ever run BigChain, you were running it just privately, really.
Yeah.
Most of the time. So it was a slightly different paradigm, but is it a project that you look to for any form of inspiration or the opposite? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know too much about BigChain DB. I mean, obviously, I'm, you know, familiar with it, but I don't...
You as a kind of people. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of our research team and our developers are very much kind of keeping up to date with the latest project.
Particularly, you might even have hired some of them.
Of course, it's a very kind of small small world here in Berlin. But I think really for us, our kind of core offering will be this kind of building a blockchain application platform. So we're not so much focused on the data side of things.
Something like Hyperledger has too, with the Hyperledger Compose, which is also interesting.
Yeah.
They kind of push it as a something that a business analyst can use, which I don't think is true right now,
but that's the goal, right?
Okay. So your role with Lisk is developer relations, developer evangelist, developer advocate. I don't know. It depends on the company and the culture, really, but
yeah,
somewhat the same, which is still a relatively new role, even in Europe, for general tech, but especially in the blockchain space. It's a space where they're only starting to hire things like technical writers, community managers have been around for a while, but mostly because of the ICO stuff. But technical writers, developer relations, support engineers, these sorts of roles that actually make the stuff understandable. And I won't go into too much detail what that means right now, because I think it's a role that depends on the company. Some are in sales, some are in engineering, some are in marketing. It really depends on the company. It's one of those very nebulous roles.
Yeah.
But in my mind, i.e. a role which is sort of sitting somewhere between product, engineering, support, a little bit of soft sales and marketing as well.
Yeah.
The interesting aspect you have at the moment is you've already kind of admitted that a lot of the tooling isn't available yet. So what do you, I don't mean this in a bad way, but what are you promoting, for want of a better word, to developers right now in your role?
Okay, so one thing, so some our developer tooling is there, but we're just going to keep adding to it. So Commander and Elements are there as projects. But obviously there's a lot of, you know, we haven't released our SDK, which is kind of the, you know, essentially the core offering. So we are, you know, and you're right, it's a very kind of, it can be a very wide reaching role. And I think particularly it's very interesting with something like blockchain, which is such a highly technical product. And I think kind of developer relations is a very essential role in that, because communicating to developers, understanding their needs, understanding what people are trying to, you know, do with the project, what are their pain points. So it's a lot of kind of, I'm working, you know, I sit in marketing, but I'm with the developers every day. So acting as this kind of bridge in between the two, and communicating that. So, you know, heavily involved in our blogs and vlogs and meetups and presenting, but also we're now doing a lot of work into terms of mapping who's in the community now, but also how do we reach out to developers outside the blockchain space, because we want to bring people in, and we need to kind of understand sort of what are the motivations for a developer who's, you know, maybe they have quite a lot of experience outside of blockchain. What are we giving them that makes them want to kind of build with Lisk? What are we going to offer them? So there's a lot of angles and there's a lot of parts to it. And yeah, it's a very exciting role.
And so I guess you hit upon a lot of challenges in the space too. Like a lot of traditional developers are somewhat skeptical of blockchain as having a point, as being nothing more than vaporware, etc. So how much have you pushed out of the safe space into that wider space? And what's the kind of, if you have, what are the kind of interactions you've had so far, and so, how have they been?
Yeah, so I mean, last week, development team was at React Day. I wasn't there. So we definitely are kind of building out that. And we get developers, like, so we had a meetup last week as well in Amsterdam, and we had developers from Stripe, and we're getting developers outside of, out of the blockchain space. And I think partly because at Lisk, we've always had this focus on accessibility and having readable documentation.
And being somewhat realistic.
Yeah.
Promises. Well, to a point. So there's been a few things that slipped off the roadmap slightly, but apart from that,
Yeah, and it's, I mean, we can't, when you speak to developers, it's not about kind of selling some crazy ICO vision. It's more about practically what can you do? Where are you at? And being very realistic with that. And yeah, just putting, we have a, you know, team of people also writing documentation, and all of our developers are, you know, also available on our community channels. And we also see actually what's kind of nice is within our community, we have a lot of developers who are kind of also helping onboard people. So you can go to the Lisk chat, and in the help channel, there's always people kind of stepping in and helping out. So we really kind of want to grow that community of people who are excited by the project, who are building with it, and also helping people onboard people as well.
And I mean, a common thing that some developer relations people do, it, again, it depends on the company, budgets, etc., is things like conference talks and stuff like that. If that is something you have been doing, how have you found pitching Lisk as a, or things related to Lisk as a topic? Has it been easy? People in charge of CFPs often a bit blasé about blockchain space, or have you had any luck with that? Or
so we were at Blockchain Live in London.
I guess we should probably set aside the I mean, let's maybe focus first on the non blockchain events.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any success with those? Or
so we've I wasn't at React Day. Mm-hmm. I was out of the office at the end of last week. I know we were at TechCrunch also on the same day, so it was like a super busy day for us. We actually did have a lot of startups who are kind of starting to build. Spoke to the business development guys here at Lisk, and they were saying, yeah, we're getting a lot of interest from everything from like GovTech to a whole range of kind of sectors. So they're kind of in the process of mapping out kind of which use cases do we want to align with. But we do get a lot of, in fact, we get a lot of people kind of inquiring, like, how can we start building with Lisk already?
I think it's a hard one to sell. I think that dose of reality is an important one. The community has been a little up itself, shall we say, for a little bit too long. And various events have maybe started to get a bit of a dose of, what's the word? There's a great word for that, and I can't think what it is. There's a phrase for sometimes, a much needed dose of reality. I'm sure there's a better word, but I can't think what it is.
I think certainly, particularly with where we're at now,
and it humbles you a bit more. And then, the conversation starts to become more balanced. And yeah, I hope to see more pragmatic talks at developer conferences in the future about the use of blockchain technology, hopefully.
Yeah.
We'll see if they let us in the door.
I think definitely with where we're at now in terms of the market being quite a strong bear market, which I think for us who are developers and have an interest in the technology, these are actually really interesting times, because this is when we build.
Actually, this is actually an interesting thing that is very, I'm glad you brought that up. Currently, mostly Lightcurve/Lisk is funded by ICO revenue.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you have a tradable token.
Yeah.
It's not been a good time for tradable tokens.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure what that's meant for Lisk.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard much, so it probably hasn't been too drastic.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, it's interesting when we get into this, maybe not so relevant for what people are doing with Lisk, but with some of the other platforms, you know, like putting a token value on people's input to systems and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the economy has been a fundamental part of some of these,
mm-hmm.
and the only thing that in theory makes them work.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, shock horror, when there's a tradable asset, there's also a significant amount of people who just look to profit from that with no input into the system at all.
Yeah.
And that is collapsing a little bit. And in some respects, a lot of the technical people say this is a good thing because now we can focus on the technology.
Mm.
But of course, if the entire technology is also partially funded by that, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. But I mean, how has Lisk as a project found the slight increased skepticism in the value of tokens? Is it a good thing to you? Is it a bad thing? Is it a short-term bad thing, but maybe a long-term good thing?
I think we're kind of fortunate in terms of what we do and what we offer, in that we aren't, it's not like part of our core values. So we are building this platform, which is going to be very much around developers being able to create these blockchain applications. Now, of course, we have a Lisk token, and that is part of our ecosystem, but we're not like a currency project. We're not.
It doesn't matter if you are or you're not, people still trade.
Of course. And like, and we're also, fortunate in the sense that we've been professionally, financially managed. We've got, that's been handled by the Lisk Foundation. So we've kind of been, we're not affected by it in that sense, but obviously we do see changes in the community. So on community channels, now it's the people who are still engaged with the project, it's becoming more of the people who are technically interested. And I think that's why it is interesting for us from a sort of developer point of view, because now maybe there's less distractions and we don't have to get, you know, waylaid into these Lambo conversations and stuff. So it's obviously it's painful. I mean, people have kind of lost a lot of money, but I think it's necessary also for the industry because I think things were being overpromised.
Get us out of the hype cycle again. Yeah. And hopefully the media will start focusing on. And often the point is often made for technology to be accepted into the mainstream, we almost have to stop talking about it.
Yes.
You're just using it without even knowing.
Yeah, there's almost that period where it kind of goes quiet and people are like,
oh, did that die? It's like, no, it's everywhere.
It's again,
you just stopped reading crazy articles about it. So to wrap up, we already, usually I ask people what's on the roadmap, but that was actually one of the main conversation points. So is there anything we haven't mentioned that you want to make sure is mentioned?
Definitely follow our channels. So we have regular communication in terms of our updates with our development blog. And then also please join us on List Chat and check out our GitHub as well.
And that interview with Rachel Black from Lisk rounded off this first episode for the new year and the first episode of this show under this name of the Weekly Squeak. I have been Christian Chiller. You can find more about me at christianchiller.com. If you've enjoyed the show, please share, please rate and review. And you can find ways to support the show at christianchiller.com/support. Until next time, thanks for listening.